Ted.
Hi, Ted. This is John Case.
Hey, John. How are you?
You got us. I had to do these calls in sort of segmented fashion because something happened with my Skype interface. That's the best I can tell you. Okay. Anyway, Ted Bettner, executive director, right, of West Virginia Budget and Policy.
Yes, Center on Budget Policy. Yep.
Center on Budget and Policy. And a not infrequent guest on our program over the years here, and I want to welcome you today. Kat on earlier, and she gave a pretty good rundown of the immediate task confronting us with respect to the tax bill. But maybe you could drill down a little bit more on West Virginia. She covered the healthcare aspect in particular. But are there other aspects besides, in addition to the healthcare, where you feel that there would be an impact directly on the state?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to know is West Virginia is one of 19 states that will actually, over the time period of these tax cuts, over the 10 years, will actually pay more in taxes than they get in cuts. So on the net, West Virginia will be paying more in federal taxes by the end of the 2027, then they will get in tax cuts. That's important to remember. So for West Virginia, it's clear it's not a tax cut. That's the first thing to understand, too, and to understand that the tax cuts that are being given are given to corporations and the wealthy. Those are permanent. And the tax cut, the small trinkets of tax cuts, $50, $100, are being taken away by 10 years from now. And that it means that West Virginia is not going to benefit from it. Most West Virginians make under $75,000 a year, and that's what the estimates show, that those people under $75,000 will receive a tax increase, not a tax cut. So it really is a scam. And unfortunately, we've had many people in Congress in West Virginia that are supporting it, and one that's undecided, which is, I just cannot really fathom or understand it. And they're trying to base that all on trickle-down economics, but somehow if we give corporations more money, which they are sitting on $2.4 trillion in cash right now, if we give them more, that'll just trickle on down to workers eventually, and they'll receive the benefits from that. And that is just way outside of mainstream economics. They're relying on a very conservative tax foundation estimate, which is funded by large corporations. They just had their tax ball in Washington. Huge, large corporations all support them, and they want it. So they get the information that they need. Right. But for the everyday West Virginia, this is just a bad deal.
Well, I mean, there's been a long history to the trickle-down economic theory. I think that it became very popular just about the time that the opposite in real life began to take place, where we got less and less and less of a share of the national income in the hands of working people, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I mean, about 1973, right? I mean, we're... something like that. When did Reagan first run? 68? No, he did. What was his first campaign?
He was California's governor, and then
That's right. He was California.
Yeah, I mean that all happened too a little bit under Carter as well. When he deregulated the airlines, trucking industry. I mean, a lot of these things happened too, and after that sort of beginning of the neoliberal period in the late 70s, the privatization, on unions.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's just saying, I'm sorry, that little experiment where lift all boats, arise. We're not going to do that anymore.
We can't lift all the yachts. You're not going to lift us up.
It's just, I would think 1976 it was that Jim Mattis was still the founder and leader of the United Electrical Workers, and he gave a very interesting address where he been reading, Reginald Jones, who at the time was the CEO of General Electric and also the head of the Business Roundtable and practically the employer of Ronald Reagan, okay, previous employer anyway. Remember General Electric Theater with Ronnie?
Yeah.
Anyway, and Ron was, and this guy, and this whole thing came up there. We can't do Roosevelt anymore. We have to capitalize at a rate that just will not permit us to do that. Okay, and they did it, sort of.
And I think one of the corollary effects, too, actually, I was telling, we were in a meeting yesterday with Senator Manchin's office talking about this, but one of the more corrosive things that happen too is when you cut income taxes and you drop those top rates on very high income and corporations, you're basically just empowering them in the political process. So, I mean, the fact that we're losing revenue by cutting the corporate income tax is bad enough, but the real corrosive impact is you're increasing the wealth and power of corporations to have even more influence over the political process.
That's right.
And that, in some ways, over the long term, is even more detrimental.
I don't know how long.
As we lowered the.
How long term, Ted? I don't know. I don't know how long term we're talking about here. I think we're in pretty substantial political peril right now.
This is all happening at a time when inequality is at its highest peak, when the middle class is shrinking. You know, what's a period in American history, if you go back to Roosevelt, even Dwight Eisenhower, we had very high tax rates on high income, that we valued the idea that, hey, maybe there shouldn't be billionaires.
Maybe there shouldn't be people in this that are that high up
that can have a huge impact on our political system. And that was a value that was, you know, held by Republicans and Democrats back then. But that's been gone. That's what I'm trying to say.
When
you lower those rates, you do all those things. You incentivize financial capital. Yeah. And now we have a huge financial sector with billionaires, hedge fund managers. These people are just having an enormous say over the political process with Democrats and mostly Republicans, but some Democrats too. And that has taken, you know, had a huge negative impact on the economy and been one of the leading factors of huge growing income inequality. And the reason that your paycheck is not as much as it used to be, you know, you're working harder, more people are working, you're as productive as you've ever been, but you're not sharing in that.
But it's not
mainly because of those reasons.
But it's not hard to explain either. And this discussion, I see it go on online, you know, oh, was it race or was it the economy or was it the economy or was it race that somehow gave rise to this right wing, the Trumpism kind of phenomenon? And I mean, it's to me, the two are so interrelated that, you know, if everybody gets poorer for 40 years, you're going to start scrambling for crumbs. I mean, this is a common, you see this happen all the time. And if you're going to start scrambling for crumbs, then all of a sudden it's dog eat dog and all the negative factors, whether it's race or everything else, you know, everything that is a reason why I shouldn't help you and why it should come to me and not you. That whole mentality. Okay. But when people get poor, they don't get all that generous. It's true. They don't. Even if you're in middle class and someone says, well, you're better off than those guys, that those black skinned guys down there below you. He says, well, I'm still headed downhill. And I, you know what I mean? You can see how all kinds of just unbelievably divisive things can be used to, it's his fault. I just, you know, it's somebody else's fault.
That whole thing. I think they've autonomized the economy too. People are individuals more. They're in their homes. They're watching TV. They're not out talking to one another. You've seen that huge breakdown of social capital. I mean, unions used to play a huge role in West Virginia, especially in rural areas, educating people about what's going on, getting together, having picnics, you know, building that capital and talking to people. And now people are just more alone because now both people in the household have to work full-time. Where, like, you know, if you go back to the 70s, you could have a pretty good job at Weirton Steel or, you know, make pretty good wages, send your kids to college. That's not around anymore. And you don't have the time that you used to have to be able to devote to things because everybody has to work. You're just barely getting by. And that's one way to sort of crush the system, crush, you know, down on workers and not give them the bargaining power that they once had.
I think if you get bargaining power back, I mean, we're talking about a pretty significant political institutional change. That you know, like the Wagner Act when it was passed, you know, took place in the context of a very industrially led, you know, labor movement, frankly, at the time, and you know, and a political economy that kind of grew out of that, that doesn't exist anymore or is much changed. The service economy is very different. Okay, the huge public sector. Regardless of what everybody says, is a different kind of animal. Also, in terms of what is collective bargaining, or what should it achieve? It should achieve higher wages first, okay? And the question is, how does it do that? And on what's the theory? I mean, is the theory that if the economy rises 1%, that both profits and both returns to capital and labor should do likewise, like they did for about 35 years? I mean, it looks like an exception in U.S. history. But is there any way, is that a stable society? Can you say that should be a principle on which we're going to have economic policy? And I think so. But I mean, that seems in doubt. Whether it's been 40 years, at least, now we have almost a revolutionary challenge ahead of us. I mean, I see the weakening of institutions, and that brings into play all kinds of forces that we saw some of in the 60s, but we're going to see more of it, I'm afraid. We're already seeing it in some ways, in weird ways, to me. I worry about this mass shooting.
It's a very Herculean task we have ahead of us to increase bargaining power. And I think, I go to conferences all the time. I always feel like we're always trying to figure out exactly how to fill the vacuum of labor. And it's hard to do that with affinity groups, hard to do that with Move On and all these different groups, because people just aren't attached to it like they are with their paycheck. If you have a union, it's just very different. There's a real guided self-interest there, too, directly into your pay. And I think trying to fill that vacuum is just one of the bigger challenges of the progressive movement in the country.
It's a serious thing.
I've not seen any good answers to that.
Hey, do you think the China deal is somehow if the tax bill ruins West Virginia, we still have this $80 billion Rock Candy Mountain headed our way. Is that playing into this at all, or is that
a sign? I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably a little bit of middle-income people in West Virginia that probably think, hey, we'll get a sugar high, maybe we'll get some tax cuts in a little bit, that'll be fine. And they're not thinking long-term. And then the China deal, usually a deal is when two people bring something to the table, like, hey, I'll give you this, you give me that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the real question is, what is the state giving? How is it a deal if the state's not giving something for that?
Hey, when are they going to when does the rest of the memorandum of understanding get seen by anybody?
That's a good question. A very good question. I mean, the fact that they're cagey with it makes you skeptical about what exactly the deal is.
Yeah, I mean,
had significant gas development already. I mean, there's been billions and billions of dollars in capital investment in Dallas, West Virginia, Ontario, a bunch of places have already done a lot of that. My guess is we're probably near $6 to $8 billion in capital investment just in natural gas processing distribution. And the question is, well, how did that work out? How well is everybody doing? In West Virginia, do we have more jobs or fewer jobs when that happened? On the aggregate, in West Virginia, we have fewer jobs than we did, 10 years ago, fewer private sector jobs. So,
yeah.
I mean, shared prosperity and natural gas development don't exactly go hand in hand.
I don't think that's one of the issues. It's the curse of natural resources. It's probably true nowhere in the world does it work that way.
Right? Yeah, Norway is the only outlier. And that's because they have a $1 trillion trust fund like we tried to set up here with the Future Fund.
Yeah.
And other states have them, too. It's very different. They're the only country that I know that escaped the resource curse.
It's very difficult. I guess you have to be practically... I guess Libya was doing okay for a while, except for Muammar Gaddafi.
Not exactly a thriving democracy.
No, but I think he was paying for some health care around the place. Remember, he had some kind of Libyan socialism, something going on where he was providing benefits and education pretty widely. That was the part of the payoff, right? You hand out some benefits, you get an army, you stay in
power. The problem is you just don't create a very good quality of life when you have especially in West Virginia where everything's very close-knit. Out west, there's huge out in Wyoming, right? I mean, it's a very different situation. Same with Montana. I mean, you can really find yourself getting away from that stuff pretty easily. But in West Virginia, it's right in your collar. It's right next door. It's very different.
Do you have have you guys been meeting with any of the Congress people, Manchin, and what do they have to say?
We've had some meetings. I think our U.S. House of Representatives delegation's been all over tax reform. I don't think there's anything that's going to stop them. Same with Senator Capito. I mean, Senator Manchin, as you read in the Hill yesterday, is saying he's not a no vote yet. But my guess is that he would vote no based on what it is right now. But really trying to find that middle ground for him. I don't think it's going to be achievable going to be very close to see what happens. And the worst part is it's just going to be a Trojan horse, you know, for later. And then we're going to pivot to the deficit. Oh, God, a rising deficit. The growth didn't happen like we thought. And now we have to cut Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. That's the playbook. We've been down this road before. You know, yes. I mean, I remember when Senator Manchin led a whole, you know, had the Simpson-Bowles Commission come to Charleston. I remember being there at the Culture Center. This was a huge deal. The debt's rising. Oh, my gosh. Deficits. Now it's something, oh, we don't care that much.
Yeah.
The same Republicans who are all worried about the debt and the deficits suddenly don't care. And they'll pivot to that here in a year or two.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. The same old narrative isn't putting any money in anybody's pocket for it. So, except our friends at the top.
Same thing. You know, just overall for West Virginia, the tax deal is just terrible. We're actually going to be paying more in taxes. That's your first thing. Yeah. That's not good. And we're going to actually be raising taxes on the people who are trying to make ends meet. Lower income people are going to be paying more. College students, I mean, a whole gaggle of different provisions in the bill will negatively impact the state. And the fact that most of all of our congressional delegations on board should be a wake-up call to everybody to educate and, you know, think about what they want to do in the election.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so the elections are coming up, and we're what, a year, less than a year now away from any possible change. For example, you feeling optimistic or no? Or you want to comment on that as a budget?
Yeah, absolutely. Person. I don't really. I mean, we just work on policy and analysis.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think with West Virginia, you just never know. I mean, I think there's not enough people that vote in West Virginia. We have some of the lowest voting turnouts. I think it's somewhat because of the candidates. We don't have people that are representing what they care about, and sometimes it just looks like a big PR show, and it's very difficult to figure out where people stand on issues. You know, and part of it's thriving. Like, just to give you another example is tax reform. They're using numbers from that. A very conservative tax foundation, Koch brother funded tax foundation, say middle class people are going to get a raise. I mean, like, that's what happens. They end up using that information and doing that.
Right.
Some people end up believing it.
Right. That's fake economics.
Very sad state of affairs.
All right, pal. Well, listen, thank you for doing the hard work of keeping track of this and trying to update people. I remember the last time I posted your remarks on this that I got a lot of interest. I got a lot. I usually don't get that many likes, but I got a lot with yours. So anyway.
Oh, good.
Anyway, so maybe you got to think about. I saw this remark, by the way, on Facebook the other day. Told you that, gee, Ted, you sound so good. Maybe you should consider running for office yourself. What do you say when people make that remark? I think you've heard it before. So
yeah, I mean, I think the political conditions in West Virginia are just so uncertain. Don't want to be a sacrificial lamb.
Yes, right. Oh, I'll put my head on the block.
The mood's going to have to dramatically
change. Shoot me! Shoot me! Okay. Right. Okay. Well, listen. Thank you so much for taking part in the conversation today, and
hey, you bet, John.
Look forward to talking to you soon. Okay, man. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.